It's a real honor to be back and to be with you again. I was just mentioning to Robert, I think the last time I did this was when I wrote my first book back in the fall of 2010. It's funny, the theme is the good, the bad, the ugly. I don't know who it is here. My first book was called Left Out, Saskatchewan's NDP in the Relentless Pursuit of Mediocrity. Oh, there's one there. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Okay. But, you know, the funny thing about that title, it was a title that really gave everybody clear warning exactly what the book was about. There wasn't a lot of mystery. The funny thing about the book was it sold much more than I'd ever expected. I didn't know much about writing a book. So the first book came out on the 20th of October, 2010, and by December 31st, 2010, it had become the top-selling book in Saskatchewan for 2010. Sold 10,000 copies. But that was the nature of the book. It was political. It had a sharp, pointy edge on it. A lot of political people bought it to see if they were in it. Others bought it to see what I said about people who were in it. So it was an interesting foray into writing. The new book is something completely different. I was telling this to a friend, and I said, you know, it's difficult to explain what a book is when it's really an assortment of newspaper columns and reflections. And the friend said, well, that sounds like Gormley 2, 3, 4, and 5.0. And I said, that's probably a better description. This book was the creation of some editors who sat down with 550 newspaper columns from the first ones that I wrote in the summer of 2001 until when the book came out just before Christmas, and went through thematically about 50 to 60 different areas. So it's an interesting foray on a much broader perspective than certainly the first book was, which was very, very political. So this book, and again, you learn this as a writer. I mean, I'm a radio broadcaster for a living. I speak on the radio. I practice some law. I do labor relations and employment work for the parent company that owns the broadcasting facility I work in. But what I do on the radio every day is opinion and commentary. And I try and stimulate people to first of all, to think, but also to speak and participate in the dialogue. So when you write newspaper columns, they actually become much more autobiographical than you think they do. And it's interesting when you see an assortment of columns that span 12 years, you then begin to realize how much as a writer, first of all, words matter, but secondly, how much the imprint of those words over time becomes a passage through your own life. And this book covers a lot. The other thing that the Gormley Papers was the working title, and that's good enough. You know, the editors were going over the columns. And then I was at the meeting, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with the books, and I'm not really, but second book, so you're at this brainstorming where they're sort of shopping titles, and the best way often to get titles is to talk to friends and talk to other people. And the retired school teacher who was the senior editor says, Gormley Papers, I'm right and you know it. And I looked and I said, geez, where'd you get that? And she said, I heard you yelling that to somebody on the radio last week. So I thought, okay, mea culpa, it's me. Of course, the hidden part of it, or the not so subtle part, of course, as a political conservative, it speaks to my politics and my political view of the world as much as it does my talk show host who says he's right, and you know it. The other thing that about this book, which was a really intriguing way to pass 12 years, was the design people thought it would be interesting to leave slightly wider margins, and as we would revisit the columns, I would make marginal notes. So there is a little bit of a follow-up, because some of these columns go back to 2001, 2002, so I'll write a note in the column reaffirming just how correct I was, perhaps reaffirming that I wasn't as correct as I thought I was, or the different change revolution in different subjects. So it was a really great adventure to be a part of. The other thing about the book is it's an extension of the radio program in that when you do a show like I do, which is 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, moved over 46 weeks a year, moved over thousands of topics and thousands of guests and many thousands of callers, you really begin to pick a lot of things up along the way. So the beauty of this was they indulged me that between chapters, I would just have little reflections on certain things. I mean, the very first one is a friend over lunch says, I've become a curmudgeon. Opinionated, cantankerous, difficult, crusty, and surly. I'm okay with all of that, but throw in old and it really hurts. Realizing now that I'm older today than when my father epitomized everything ancient, I was never supposed to be that old guy. But at least I'm not sitting on the porch barking at dogs. Not yet. And then between every chapter, I have a little go. In fact, there's one, for example, where I reflect on fashion accessories. Holy cow, usually when I speak, I get called on this one. The continuing fashion accessory rant. Guys who wear hats indoors. Anything from ball caps to hipster fedoras, sorry, buddy, drives me crazy. The last generation of men who wore hats all the time took them off, and they didn't have a bucket full of hair care products to deal with hair hat problems. Being seen in public anytime wearing Crocs, pajama bottoms, or any pants that reveal your butt crack. Fanny packs. Nothing says douche like truck nuts, those dangling testicles from the trailer hitch of a pickup truck. Nothing. Except guys who wear white sunglasses. So there are these little rants between each chapter and everything from fashion to current life, and admittedly, they're the rants of a guy who rants. The other interesting part about a book like this is because it transects or traverses a number of years and a number of topics, and I'd mentioned how one sees themselves in this, is the topics have an interesting range. There are about 50 to 60 of them. And one of the most interesting chapters was the chapter called How Does It Feel? And it was to go through a series of different columns I'd done over the years. How it feels to be the mom and dad of a child who has been sexually abused. How it feels to deal with depression. Mental health, as many of you know, is a big thing with me, and we all have certain things that move us. How it feels to deal with the suicide that sometimes comes from depression. So there's some pretty thought-provoking, gloomy, quite frankly, items. How it feels to say goodbye to your dad at the funeral when you bury him. And that was one. It was odd. My wife had never read this book. She's a woman of great taste. She avoids many things I write. And we were on a trip recently. She reads the book, and I look over. She's crying. And I thought, geez. And that was the column that got her. And that was a column written back in 2003 when my dad had died. And then I read it, and then I started crying because I hadn't read it in years. So there are certain journeys here that I think touch all our lives. But the most interesting chapter was the last one. I couldn't believe in all of the years I've done the show how many times I've talked to really cool people with neat advice on living better. How to be a happier person. How to have a relationship that endures. How to raise better kids. So the last chapter is actually a collection of really interesting columns I've written over the years on how we live. Welcome. The column I wanted to begin today reading for you is called
"On a Snake Cloud, All the Snakes."
Thank you.
This country. You're welcome.
Would you like that back?
Or no, it's yours.
Thank you. Tansy. Good. The column I... The column I want to start with, and there's actually a fair bit here on the era of protest we can get into, including Aboriginal protest and some of these issues. Would you like to join me?
Not with the forked tongue.
No, you can.
We have a history of speaking with people with forked tongues.
Yeah, you can join me if
it's
you like.
It's all lies, deception, it's all a land grab, and you all belong to it. We don't speak with people with forked tongues anymore.
Sure,
do you? We learned our lesson.
Sure, do you believe that?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Would you like to join a discussion, or would you like to sort of?
How can I discuss things with a forked tongue?
Would you like to stifle debate? And I guess this is the issue, isn't it? In fact, if you'd like, I can read you the.
You can talk to me on the radio.
Look,
say your shit to us Indians. Say it to my face.
I'm what of you?
You say whatever you say to our faces. Never mind hiding behind the radio.
Would you like me to read the...
No, you can read. You can read what you say on the radio every day.
Sorry? Yeah. Well...
Come on.
I'm in your hands because I'm, you know, I want to talk to you. I love a good debate. Thank you. Oh, don't throw things. That's not good. So if you want to continue this, I think this is a great debate. But if universities are places to stifle debate, consider me stifled. So... Would you like me to speak?
Go ahead, speak.
Is there?
You got the biggest forked tongue in all the radio.
Is there a reason you have your face covered? Do you fear the idea that you could identify a defensible point of view?
Do you fear Indians like you've been fearing us for the last 500 years?
I don't
and
fear you.
Treating us the way you guys have been treating us on the radio,
no, I
on
don't.
Television. Everything!
Do you feel better?
No, I don't feel better.
Okay.
Not until you guys get rid of your forked tongue.
But why don't you take...
stop your lies!
Why don't you take your mask off?
No, it stinks in here.
Take your mask off.
It stinks in here.
So is... Face. Yeah, show us your face. I mean, is that how you reveal your points of view?
Hey.
I mean... Now, this guy here at least is... And I'm glad you're here.
Be a man. Show your face.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your name?
Doesn't matter who my name is. You speak with the forked tongue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My name's John.
I know who you are, John.
I would like...
I know who you are.
Okay.
I know you're redneck ways.
By the way, I'll just keep talking. When you've been a politician... I've had this happen before.
Now you got
okay.
reason to hate Indians. And anyone
no.
of you people that live in my territory, if you got a reason to hate Indians, now you have a good reason to hate us.
We don't hate.
You got a good reason.
Why would we want
we
a reason?
We signed treaties here so that you guys can live here in coexistence with us. Not the other way around. Not the other way around.
Actually,
as a... You're raped and molested in your schools. We're sick and tired of our children being stolen. Social services, your government departments. We're sick and tired of all of that. When's it going to end? When will it end? You think I'm stupid and crazy?
No.
Is that what you guys think?
No, but...
Standing up for our women?
But how do we...
Standing up for our children?
She says.
Does that make me crazy?
No.
No, nobody suggested you're crazy.
Not at all, brother.
There's got to be some different words instead of your forked tongue all the time on the radio.
Amen.
I understand you.
You better understand. You've had 500 years to understand. I know more about you guys than you guys know about us.
I
know about your secret societies, your religions, and all your damn, all your raping and your pillaging of our women and children.
Secrets.
We know everything that you guys have been doing to us.
Actually, this... The,
you guys don't know nothing about
the
us.
The expert on secret
you
societies
think
is here.
Drunken Indian.
No, nobody says that. Who says that?
You guys all say it.
Who?
All the time,
can
every
you,
day.
Can you name
it? University.
Can you
they
name
they think we're some cowboy and Indian movie. That's still playing.
Can you name? Let's talk about this. I mean, I'm sensing a great deal of frustration, but you're pointing everywhere.
We've been patient for 500 years, John.
Okay, Robert.
Tell me the frustration.
I'm more than happy to continue, but
500 years, John.
So. What's that to me? Oh, thank you.
Well, it's a real nice.
And what's here?
Thank you, sir.
Good. No, I.
John, just cut your shit on the radio.
Hey.
We don't need it.
No. Excuse me.
Yeah. Right?
Don't get in my way. I'm trying to have a discussion, please.
Yeah.
I need to.
I don't need to discuss anything with you. Absolutely. You guys are the same.
Shutting down a
Well, the problem is this stops conversation, and the last time I checked, universities were places we wanted to encourage them. But, so are you done?
Part of the conversation that we wanted to have with the right wing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would really welcome it, but is this the way you generally encourage a conversation?
Of course.
Really? So is this the way that we deal with it in seminars at university? Do you deal with it this way in a seminar in your grad class, your native studies class?
Yeah.
So this is done at seminars.
Yeah.
Gee, no seminar I've taught at a university.
Welcome to the U of R.
Like, well,
have you kept up on the news lately about what's going on?
I think I'm probably guilty of keeping up on the news.
We'll have some time for a question and answer.
So. Yeah, no, I'm good. The problem was that I had, I don't want to inflame. I had a number of columns on Idle No More and the politics of Occupy. And I thought, is this the time to get into it? Perhaps it might be. But the column that I wanted to begin today with is called Yes, These Are the Best of Times. It was a memorable conversation with a young couple. They mentioned the people who kept telling them that we're living in difficult times. They said they didn't see it, and neither do I. We discussed standard of living, which prompted the guy, whose hobby is international travel, to compare most places he's been in the world to modern life here. While observing that many of the world's people, even in developed countries, would give anything for our lives, he said, "Is it always like this? People telling us that catastrophe is just around the next corner." My mind cast back to being his age. I smiled and said, "That's pretty well the way it is. Get used to ignoring the perpetually dissatisfied and savor every minute." With the exception of pioneers or those who lived through the Great Depression, many in today's life have never known true hardship. Sure, there were the early 1980s when many of us renewed mortgages at interest rates of 19%. Which was life-defining in an ugly way. But generally, most people in today's society are blessed. We've also learned that in the case of the most apocalyptic predictions by the naysayers, the fear of the event is usually far more powerful than what actually turns out to happen. We live in the best time in history. Sure, there will be obstacles to be scaled, challenges are never absent, but compare the times you live in to other times. The same thought hits me every morning at about the same time jets of steaming hot water jolt me awake in the shower. We live better today than most of history's kings. In the column, I go through the plumbing in the Palace of Versailles, which I won't bore you with. What we take for granted today is technology, more computing power in your smartphone than full-sized mainframe computers of decades past. Well over 90% of households own appliances, phones, and TVs of a sophistication and a size unimaginable even in the 1980s. If you came of age, even in the 1970s, never mind earlier, the tech array was pretty simple. A stereo in the living room, maybe a record player for the kids, the family TV, who'd ever need more than one of those, the radio in the kitchen, the wall phone, and if your family was really tossing money around, maybe an extension phone somewhere else. Very few families, including even most middle-income professionals, ever went on warm winter vacations. And when it did get hot, who had air conditioning? Today, one half of Canadian homes have AC. In Saskatchewan, it's 60%. Cheaper prices and greater availability have flattened out what used to be class distinctions based on consumer products. At one time, the middle class had stuff the working class didn't, the upper middle class had different stuff than the lower middle, the truly uppers had stuff none of us would ever see. Today, from audio and video systems to tablets, smartphones, notebooks, laptops, desktops, gaming systems, even where income disparity exists, more consumer products are spread across a greater number. But all of this, the critics sniff, is consumerism. So what about values? What about human rights, tolerance, diversity? All have improved dramatically even from 35 years ago. The most recent UN Human Development Index trend has Canada 11th in the world, with a national life expectancy that grew by 20 years from 1931 till now. Canadians can expect now to live to 81 years, 1 year longer than the average among the world's 34 nations of the OECD. Also in the OECD's Better Life Index, Canadians were ahead of the average in earnings, in education, in sense of community, and life satisfaction. The International Living Quality of Life Index puts us ninth out of 194. You should see the bottom, in Afghanistan, Chad, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. This is not to deny that we will continue to have challenges, but carefully watch the perennial complainers. There are often two camps. There are those who simply cannot be happy about anything. Know who they are, accept them for who they are, and hug them. The second category are the social activists and mischief makers, often of the political left, who are selling messages that generally will not take without a well-established foundation of class struggle, pessimism, and despair. They will do relentlessly whatever it takes to make you feel unhappy and dissatisfied. The message I left the young couple was this: for some, the end is always near. We are living in the best of times, and only you will determine how to make them better. And the marginal note I scrawled was, if on the facts you can choose optimism, why wouldn't you? So that was, because there's an entire chapter on the best of times, worst of times. And again, we can have great debates on all sorts of issues, whether the debates are on the UN and the OECD's Human Living Index, whether it's on other measures or benchmarks. But I say this to millennials, people born since the early 80s, talk to your mom and dad, talk to your grandparents, and talk to their parents about generally the flattening out of our society in terms of what we enjoy, what we take for granted, and a sense of safety. So that's one of the things I get into in the book. But the book, of course, as they say, traverses and transects a number of different issues. So I'm usually better and feel better when we're having a back and forth. So that's really all I came to talk about in terms of prepared comments. But any questions you have, anything you'd like to discuss, if you'd like to challenge me on certain issues, feel free. This is what debate and dialogue are all about.
Well, most of your arguments are based on consumer culture and coming from a lineage of people who are kind of move in the opposite direction in regards to value systems. How does your argument kind of justify the idea that consumerism is going to save you? And it sounds like this like imaginary
everybody else who doesn't believe in you. Oh,
doesn't believe in me?
Apparently there are several people who don't agree with what I say. But no, here's the point. And this is why in that particular column, I laid out the argument that if you look at straight consumer performance, and again, I don't agree with you, but there is a strong body of economic and political thought that says both growth, both growth and consumerism are not where we want to go.
And so you're trying to develop this argument, and it's really biased. But what could you say from the other side if you know them so well? What makes me wrong? Can you tell me that?
With respect to your assertion that consumerism involves people laying under other people, is that the assertion you'd like me to speak to?
Sure.
Okay. Generally in market economies, and remember in North America, nowhere has an open market economy, right? Generally in a competitive economy, you see people moving up as they work, as they develop, as they get educated. Many people start at a low level. But consumerism, you can view it that it is exploitation of those who produce the item, those who sell the item, but again, I would argue that on the economics of growth and GDP expansion, that doesn't hold. People do benefit by being participants in that consumer economy. Now, you can disagree with me, and you clearly do, and I'm not saying you're wrong, I'm not saying I'm right, but I don't agree with you. And this is what the debate's about. So, you know, it's, believe it or not, every single day I spend my time talking to people who might think I'm completely wrong. And I talk to a whole bunch of people who think I'm right. Yeah.
Hi. I was listening to your writing, and you talk about the better state of human rights. And I assume, are you talking the country or China? Or
in those two indexes, yeah. That's Canada. Oh, absolutely.
Or going missing. So there's definitely sort of a, I think a reasonable person would want to assess whether or not human rights are in a better state when the people who are actually from here are saying that that's not their experience. I remind you, Mr. Brogan, the man that drowned in the lake. For half an hour, his friend tried to find somebody to help him.
Terrible story. Yeah.
But that's a very common experience for a lot of non-Indigenous people that are sitting in this room. We think human rights are great. How is it for that man?
So yesterday, I know you were. I heard you were defending the Cowboys versus Indians cheerleaders, and I think what she's saying is that these stereotypes that are held against First Nations by our common society here in Regina and Canada are quite damaging, and they're literally, you know, killing people.
That indifference that those folks have in the lake, whether they felt like there
were those
possibilities,
were they Indigenous?
They were not
Indigenous.
People
no.
Who were asked to help the man who was trying to save right. The fella who was drowning. So I think about that in relation to human rights. Oh. And I think about this indifference, our community here in Regina, and I've actually lived in some other parts of this country where it's not so prevalent, where the indifference to the reality that Indigenous women are experiencing is acknowledged. And I think maybe that's the first step in ensuring that there is a balance in human rights.
Oh.
I know the right leaning is all about no one has any extra special rights. I don't necessarily. However,
I would assert, however, let me challenge you on that. That's who's right leaning.
But we all have a right to be safe.
Bingo.
Right?
Absolutely.
And so if there is a risk greater too, I don't know that we can say that human rights is something that's really come that far.
Okay. Let me address, and I don't disagree with your point. I mean, the indexes I was quoting were UN and OECD indexes nationwide, okay? I am the first one to admit that in certain areas, in certain communities, in fact, I wrote a column on the Tamara Keepness disappearance.
I remember that column.
Okay. Was that a bad column or a good column?
It's real hard sometimes for those of us who come from an Indigenous perspective to read your stuff, John. I'll be honest.
In the hours after she disappeared, nearly 6,000 hours of searching were logged by the city police, Mounties, RCMP recruits, search rescue volunteers, railway police, others, and neighbors. The neighborhood where the little girl disappeared and much of the city of Regina were turned upside down and still no sign of little Tamara. For anyone who has ever loved a child, the reaction of Regina's mayor was understandable as he choked up just thinking about how any of us would feel if it was our little one who had disappeared without a trace. Even beyond the borders of Regina, the disappearance tore into the hearts of all of us. Fearing the worst, but hoping otherwise, it was not surprising when the police concluded, after a week of searching, that some person was most likely responsible for Tamara's disappearance. And while no one says such things aloud, the chances of this ending well dramatically diminish after the first couple of days. The best of Saskatchewan people, their hearts and their souls, is never more evident when others are in great need. The same selflessness, sacrifice, and hard work that make volunteerism a way of life here shone through as hundreds of people pulled for Tamara. Searchers from in the neighborhood and out, to those staffing refreshment booths for the search teams, people came and offered what they could, and if there was nothing to offer, they hoped and they prayed. Even driving down Victoria Avenue as the search went on, the beaten-up old Dodge half-ton truck in front of me had a missing persons poster of Tamara taped in the back window. In the same province where a winter storm has small towns opening the doors to complete strangers, Saskatchewan people wear their compassion deeply. Now, the column goes into the debate on core neighborhoods and the reality of core neighborhoods and why any child has to be in a position where they're that vulnerable in their life. Is that unsafe? Well, if you would like a discussion, and again, and I get into this in a lot of columns, you have, particularly in the Aboriginal community, and not all in the Aboriginal community, but particularly in the Aboriginal community, dysfunction that goes back through the residential schools experience prior to that time. You have families that have a great deal of difficulty fending and tending for themselves. Those of us, and I mean, I was on the parliamentary committee in 1985 that amended and passed Bill C-31. I mean, I've spent an awful lot of time in Aboriginal communities in my life. So again, I appreciate your point of view. And on the human rights front, go to the core neighborhood of Regina and there are real problems. But go to other neighborhoods in Regina, go to the, again, the Aboriginal community is how big of
Saunders.
Yes.
The woman in Labrador was a university student, not
yes.
Oh. As many, I believe Human Rights Watch concluded that about 70% were not the stereotypical drug addict out on the street. They were young women who were going back to school.
Yes, absolutely.
Women who were going and working three jobs. You know, that kind of stuff. So I don't know that I would want to just compartmentalize it to a core neighborhood issue when Rev Saunders was really...
Oh, no, I mean... The missing and murdered Aboriginal women, you know at least as much as I do about this. We've all read it. We've all looked at the issues. But don't, and again, I'll push back a little, don't malign the Canadian human rights record based on the plight of one group that we're trying, all of us as a community, to move through and up and beyond. But I don't know. Why do you think it's needed?
Just last week, it was totally denied, and we've capped it off at, like, what, 825 missing and murdered Indigenous women?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's more than that, but we need our national inquiry.
I don't mean to interrupt, but, I mean, there are a lot of other people in the room, and I just wanted to be sure that everybody...
Yeah. No, I mean, again, whatever you've... Look, I answer questions all day. I debate, so let's... Certainly the cycle that began with residential schools. I mean, but let's go even to the earlier stage where you had the influence in certain communities of poverty and alcohol, which, again...
Where did the alcohol come from, John?
Well, you know where it came from.
Yeah, it took the pipe away from them, John.
Well, sure, it came as populations moved in. But again, and I was getting ready for a rant that will be on my radio show later this week.
I'll
if you...
John.
Please do. If you would like an unproductive exercise, a wholly unproductive exercise, refer to the entire community, okay? What's the population of the Aboriginal cohort in Saskatchewan? 14%. So 14% Aboriginal, 86% settler, white colonizer. Now, if you'd like a decidedly unhealthy debate, start referring to 86% of any population in a pejorative term that they don't like. And again, that's the choice of the Aboriginal activists. I've spent time with elders, and I've never with an elder or in the different sweats I've done, both in Alberta and Saskatchewan with different tribal groups, I have never had a discussion when I was a politician, when I was a lawyer, when I was a broadcaster 30 years ago or today, I have never had a discussion with a human being who masked his face and yelled so somebody else couldn't talk. Now, if that's the way you want to roll, and that's you, because you were adopting it, I don't know if you're speaking for a group, if that's the way you and that gentleman believe debate gets conducted, I can't stop you from that, but you're going to find yourselves being very unhappy.
I mean, that seems like a pretty conservative perspective, considering the debunking of, like, the hijab recently and, like, all that kind of bullshit. Like, I don't understand why a masked person is so threatening. Like, he took it off.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, these people, they are soldiers, and they're welcome to wear whatever they want. We have that freedom of speech as well.
Sure you do. But you have a freedom for other people to reject your point of view based on the way you're presenting it. And that would be a pity, because those of us who have done the Aboriginal studies, those of us who have studied constitutional law, those of us who know intimately what you're arguing, agree with some, disagree with others. And again, believe it or not, I can disagree with you. And I know that for some people in this, you know, the man with the mask, the idea that someone's going to disagree with them makes them yell louder. Well, I get that. But the point is, if you want to move to a constructive position where everybody grows, it's your choice to call people settlers and white colonizers. It's your choice to wear a mask and yell and bang a drum so someone can't speak. And I'll indulge you in that. But I'm not going to respect you. And that's the problem. That's okay. Lots of people don't. Kevin, do you have any questions? This is a familiar voice you may know. This is Conspiracy Kevin. The star of radio, right there, I'll tell you.
Oh, thank you. On that last part of the book you read there, you equated the left that when they talked about the problems in society as being pessimistic in that.
Mm-hmm.
And same with the conspiracy theorists being a wacko or a crazy in that. You know, whereas I totally see it the opposite.
Have I suggested that you're wacky or your ideas are wacky? Sure they do.
Okay, but back to this last column thing with the left. When people bring up what's wrong in society and want to work towards changing it, it's not because they're pessimistic, it's because they're optimistic. It's because they believe things can change. And they believe if they bring them out and they talk about it and people realize what's going on, more people see the damage that is being caused by our consumer society, then we can be optimistic and maybe we can see a change. And that's why we'll get on the radio, call you up, and get called crazy once in a while. Because, you know, there are a lot of people in our society who are suffering, and it is at the cost and the expense in the hands of other people. A prime example of what's going on in the Ukraine today. These people have a great choice, eh? Putin, the socialist dictator, or the EU, and their grandparents losing half of their pensions. Wow, nice choice, eh? Really. And that's all because of the powers.
You know what my great fear is with you? That one day the Bilderberg group is going to come after you, and I knew it. And I knew it all along, and I didn't save you. So no, you and I have had some great discussions over the years, and I like your style.
Have you been to Bilderberg before?
Oh, me? I couldn't get it. I couldn't rate Bilderberg.
He hasn't been on the list.
Have you been on the list?
No.
No, because, geez, I would. Yeah, Premier Wall went, and that's, I mean, who gets on the Bilderberg list? You might think so, because after all, they are the powers that be who are determining what the world is going to do next year. Yes, you did.
Based on our constitutional laws, wouldn't that be
possible? We still have a few minutes left for questions. I'm just wondering if anybody who hasn't spoken was interested in asking John a question, something that has been...
Darn it, yeah.
I'll just ask, just because you talked, you opened your book up, I haven't seen the book yet, but you go back about 20 years of your articles. Tell us
about 12 years, yeah.
So what's changed? What surprised you the most when you got the first paper you wrote here? What's changed your thinking? What hasn't changed? What's changed society?
That's an interesting question. I guess there's a whole chapter dedicated to healthcare, and I became a huge Janice McKinnon fan when, after she left politics, Dr. McKinnon got into a pretty good debate on two P's that have to be integrated into government-funded healthcare, and the P's are private and profit. And again, for somebody who's a lifetime New Democrat, who was able to speak about taking the same model that France uses, that New Zealand uses, that you have a guaranteed state medical program, yet you start to plug in insurance aspects. I don't believe any of that's changed. So it was funny, I was reading back, and this was before the Romano report came out in 2001, 2002. I think I was probably, and it was funny, not funny, it's a terrible thing, but I wrestled with the Afghanistan mission in late 2001 because of the intractable history of what's happened on any land-based attempt to bring civil society or even a resemblance of rule of law to Afghanistan. I got much more into the, and I still believe in the worthiness of the mission in terms of some of the human rights benchmarks, but as Afghanistan ended, I go back and I read the columns and I wonder, was there an alternative? And I don't know if there is an answer to that question, but I think we've all seen a significant movement in the last decade on that issue. The last chapter that I talked about, and I call it, Lessons for Life While There's Still Time, talked with an Australian palliative care nurse, a woman named Bronnie Ware, who started a blog called The Five Regrets of the Dying. And that turned into a book, and it was an amazing read. And she was a great person to talk to, and that spawned this column that said, let's begin at the end, when life's lessons are retrospective. And then I talk about meeting Bronnie Ware and having her on the show. She worked for years in palliative care with patients who had gone home to die. From spending anywhere up to the final 12 weeks of life with someone who was dying, she observed that while every patient went through a variety of emotions, every journey was different, each generally found peace at the end. When asked if there's anything they would do differently, Ware said that patients expressed five common regrets. In her book, she expressed them simply and powerfully. First, I wish I had had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life that others expected for me. And the subtitle of that was The Most Common Regret of Unfulfilled Dreams. Number two, I wish I didn't work so hard, missing a partner's companionship, a children's youth because of work. Three, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings, becoming resentful and bitter even from suppressing your feelings. Four, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends, letting friendships slide and realizing that in the end it all comes down to love and relationships. And five, I wish I had let myself be happier, realizing that happiness is a choice and you can break out of old patterns and old habits. Reading Ware's wisdom, it's helpful to know that it is never too late to undo now what we might later regret. And in her words, life is a choice. It is your life. Choose consciously, choose wisely, choose honestly, and choose happiness. And that was an amazing session I spent with her, because the more you talk to her, every single one of us can take those five regrets, even at a younger point in our life. I mean, to me, it's friends. I beat myself up on that. And of course, anytime you've got a regret, the best time is to stop now, change, and fix it. But I've let more friends slide away in my life. And I tell my kids that all the time. And in a social media world, it's a lot easier. You can be on, you know, Facebook with somebody you finished grade 12 with. But I've had different cycles in my life where I've had really, not BFFs, I mean, your best friends stick around, but really nice people you've liked, you've enjoyed their company, you've shared something. All of a sudden you move, change jobs, they move, change jobs. You look back 5 years later and you think, there was no good reason and no explainable reason for that connection to have been broken. And I guess what I find at this point in my mid-50s is I look back on a life that's been going flat out since I was 20 years old, and holy cow, I left some great people slide away. So when I was reading Bronnie Ware's Regrets of the Dying, I thought, yikes, I'm not dead yet. But get on the friends thing. And I hate to sound like your dad, but I lecture my girls on that all the time. Get your friends, keep them close, and keep in touch. Any other questions? Have we got still time, Robert? Are we?
A few minutes, yeah.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to start out by saying I grew up in a few blocks away from where Tamara Keepness is, and I'm doing pretty fine in my life right now. And my question actually is, you were referring to the statistics of our human rights, like the levels of living. Like we're a pretty good country to live in. You know, you can find a career path, you can get educated. In comparison to a First Nations condition. I know you're from, are you from the Battleford?
From Battleford, yeah.
Battleford area. About 10 years ago, there was a water crisis.
Yes.
And the community kicked in and flooded water, bottled water for the community members. But for over 10 years now, we've had about 60% of our First Nations with oil water advisory. I'm curious to find out your opinion on how that can be attacked in order to be able to compromise it and make it a better living condition. Like what steps do you think that,
it's tough. It brings me, this actually brings me back to my old life. I was in politics for 4 years, and I finished my political career because of ill health. The voters got sick of me real fast. But, you know, because this is a big issue, because I had at one time, in my days, we had 69 First Nations, not 74 today, and 23 were in my riding. So I tell you, when there was water treatment plants, lift stations, you'd come in, you'd try and get some. Again, it was always interim funding, you know, quick fix. Part of the problem, and I looked at Calvin Helene. I don't know if you've read much of his stuff. Calvin is a Winnipeg-based First Nations lawyer and business guy. Some people in the First Nations community can't stand Calvin's message. You can't. Because Calvin wrote a whole series of books called the Dependency Series. Now, he's a guy who believes, clearly, in strong, robust treaty interpretation. Again, Indigenous rights, right to self-determination. I mean, Calvin believes that.
Based on the BC model where there's no treaty.
But part of Calvin's argument is that in order to community build, you have to break a dependency cycle. So this is part of the problem with water treatment on certain First Nations. You know, you can put the money in, and pardon the metaphor, but like a funnel, you can drop the money in, you know, you'll get the lift station fixed today or the water purification. The band will do it, right? I have friends who are water engineers who do nothing but First Nations communities, and I had lunch with one of them the other day, and he said, first of all, he's encouraged because the overall expansion's getting better, but he said still there are a ton of First Nations who don't have potable water. So part of the dependency cycle is we've got to get the right resources to fix it. Like, nobody in their right mind should say, oh, hell, it's your issue, fix it. I just think that's, it's just rotten to the core. I mean, you need to help people. But there has to be, and this is the message that some First Nations leaders don't like, there has to be community building that begins to drive accountability. You know, and we've had, you know, water treatment plants on some communities, not all, break down because nobody checked the chlorination tablets for weeks. Well, again, whether it's North Battleford or Manhattan, borough of New York, or I better not name the First Nation because I'm not sure I'll name one that's in trouble. But, you know, one that's in trouble with 60 residents, you got to check the chlorine tabs, right? There has to be somebody who says, part of my day planning once every 4 or 5 days is I got to go look at the chlorine tabs. Then the argument is, and I'm a racist if I say this, but seeing as I've already been essentially suggested I'm much worse, the idea that you can say you have to have an accountability measure, that you got to check it. It's your job, because it's your family, it's your town, it's your water. You don't get a free pass. That makes me a racist. So there has to be that balance where accountability starts to break the dependency cycle, yet government has to be there on the resource side, if that makes sense.
I definitely comprehend that. Just to reiterate that, it's hard for First Nations to actually start up economic development just based upon the sheer processes that have to go through the government process. Like, there's a small community beside. I'm from Little Blackbird First Nation. We own some land in Fort Capel. We have to jump so many hurdles in order to be able to open up some kind of business or to create that economic development. How do you think it would be people that can do the processes that are required. But on the economic development side, in order to break free from dependency, we need to be able to break down those barriers from the parliamentary level. So
definitely.
How can you combat that?
It's hard. Okay, I talked to Darcy Bear. You know Darcy?
Yeah.
I would send every single young Aboriginal woman and man who has finished a public administration or business degree and spend time with Darcy. I mean, he has done, and again, it's fashionable in the activist community to sneer and, you know, make noises when you mention Darcy. But the point is, you've got to take, again, all leadership and mentoring starts with the human touch, right? None of us ever got ahead in life without somebody reaching out at some point and saying, hey, you know, I'm here for you. And inside the Aboriginal community, there is a resource challenge, to be sure, but there's, and those of you who aren't familiar with the world of economic development, it's happening. You know, the Ken Thomases, the Lester LaFons, these guys since the 80s have been doing mentorship program for young Aboriginal business people, tribal leaders, you know, this kind of thing. So it's happening, but it's frustratingly slow.
I actually...
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I can have one more question from somebody who hasn't asked one. Does anybody want to...
So on top of water treatment, it's been probably tens of thousands of more years that people existed here without needing water treatment plants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why is it not possible to go to a river and get clean water?
Not every river, but rivers that would have traditionally provided clean water.
Why do you think it is?
That's
the question. Well, no, of course I can ask you the same question, because of course your answer is, well, they're all polluted, right? So the point is, with modern water treatment, did you see the cryptosporidia numbers in the 18th century? No, because when you drank water where you had certain animals upstream, you got really, really sick with cryptosporidia. It's called beaver fever because defecation of beavers and other animals. Bingo, you'd go to another river. So, I mean, the point, I get your point, but we have to be realistic in a modern world of... If you'd like to drink water that hasn't been treated, there are water springs, there are fresh... Okay. Are we good on questions?
We are good on questions.
Okay.
We have a couple of very special things. We have coffee and cookies. If you do not eat the cookies, librarians will eat them. I've been told that librarians don't like to eat cookies, but they will if they're required to. So please eat them. We have a book sale for, I believe it's $15 for Left Out, an excellent book, one of my favorites. And the Gormley Papers for $25. Or a special deal if you get both for $35. We live in a wonderful country in Canada here. I have a lot of friends that come to Canada from all over the world, and they always tell me, you know, all the wonderful things about this country that they do not have at home. One of them, and I shouldn't have the last word, but I will.
No, this is very kind. Thank you.
One of them was from the Philippines, and she was saying, well, how many people die in a Canadian election? And I told her, well, usually zero. And
there's some heart attacks the night of the vote count.
Yes.
On all sides, but
and
you're
the
right.
Occasional assassination of party workers in Quebec once every 60 or 80 years. But there are so many things. You even have protesters tonight that came. I don't agree with people coming in and silencing other perspectives. But on the other hand, these people are not going to end up in some gulag somewhere, which
it's
is
true.
Something you certainly would not find in other countries. And certainly if any of our students here would like to protest the government, as has happened a few times at this university, they will not be expelled and permanently banned from the university like they would in some other places. And these are all things to celebrate. No country is perfect. We have lots of things to do to make our country even better. But I think if we just look on the negative, I think it's a very negative. If we look on the pessimism all the time...
You will always find it.
You will always find it, and it makes us look more poorly on our country than we really should. We should be grateful for what we have. And I thank you very much for coming here. I'm sure you'll stick around for at least
Love to.
Minutes.
Yeah.
Nobody's allowed to beat up John during the... but thank you...
Actually, they're allowed, but...
I wouldn't want to try to take him, though. It looks... Thank you very
Robert,
much, John.
Robert, thank you so much. That's very nice. Thank you.
I'd like to get a picture with you.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Here, let me just...